Local faith leaders travel to Charleston after a mass murder there. Could Jacksonville's pension deal fall apart at the 11th hour? And Jeb Bush enters the 2016 field and even slow jams the news. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live at 9, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, all the news of the week, then later, marking World Refugee Day in Jacksonville. Plus, UNF celebrates its interfaith community. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly roundtable. Here today, Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union.
Good morning.
Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner, is here.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
And Andrew Pantazzi, also of the TU.
Good morning.
Guys, it is great to have you with us on this hot Friday morning. Plenty of news from the week to discuss, from Jeb Bush entering the 2016 field to last-minute problems with that Jack's pension deal. We'll track that live on Twitter, too, as it unfolds. That vote is happening now. But first this morning, Jacksonville area residents with ties to Charleston, South Carolina, are speaking out, and some faith leaders are planning to travel to Charleston today, including Bishop Rudolph McKissick of this city. This after the mass murder of 9 people late Wednesday during a prayer meeting at the historic Emmanuel AME Church. 21-year-old suspect Dylan Roof is in police custody. The massacre at the historic church is being treated as a hate crime. Give us a call with your thoughts as we discuss this horrible story out of Charleston, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show, and we're already getting your comments on Facebook. Fred, let's begin with you. Bishop Rudolph McKissick Jr., the leader of our city's largest black church, traveled to Charleston last night. He was already planning to go, but of course, he'll now react to this tragedy, which has absolutely devastated Charleston and the nation.
Well, this is this incident happened at what is one of the oldest African-American churches in the country and probably in the South, with a storied history going back to Denmark Vesey. And it's just an awful thing. And those who have been members of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which is a very close community throughout everybody knows everybody throughout. I mean, it's just a tragic thing. And again, for it to happen on the same night that churches all across the country are having the same thing going on, Bible study, prayer meeting on Tuesday night, Bible study on Wednesday night, all across, it's everywhere. You just don't schedule a meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday because it's going to conflict with those two issues. It's just a tragic, tragic incident. But, you know, the young man was 21. This is the result of what? And I'm looking to see who the reporter is going to be that's going to get behind the what, because we won't see a trial for another year, possibly two. Who's the reporter that's going to be able to get behind the what? I understand he got his first gun, was awarded to him at 21 years old, 45 caliber, given to him by his father. So what is the what behind this, that now we see the evidence of this young man strolling into a church, waiting an hour, watching these folks, and then spewing out what he spewed out to them in the house of prayer?
And lots of comments already. Dan Scanlon on our Facebook page, Jessica writes, this meets the criteria for terrorism, an act of violence that endangered human life. Not all terrorists are brown people, and not all victims of terrorism are white.
That was brought up literally 24 hours ago on this very station during some of the NPR newscasts, that this was a case of domestic or American terrorism. And now we're seeing that he is an avowed racist who obviously has turned, something turned him into this. And then to sit next to the pastor, apparently, and then just yell something like this is for you, this is it, and then do it. I can only give credit to law enforcement for tracking him down and keeping him alive into custody.
I do find it interesting how quickly that conversation came up about what do we term this. In some ways, I always find that discussion, I'm not entirely sure how pointful it is. In some ways, call it terrorism or not, any act, it doesn't change the impact on people's lives. But that argument that we would be calling this terrorism if it was a, you know, Muslim who walked into a church. Oh, that would be terrorism. Well, this is the same thing. And somehow we do treat things differently. And, you know,
we should
We
should remember that the very first anti-terrorism laws in this country were directed at the Ku Klux Klan, and they were directed at white Southerners who were burning crosses and were lynching and were murdering black men and women across the South and across the Midwest. And we should look at this in a historical context of historically in America, domestic terrorism has been rooted in a deep-seated racism.
549-2937. We'll go to your calls in just a moment on the top stories of the week here on our Friday Media Roundtable. Fred Matthews, Annette writes on our Facebook page, any act of violence spurned by hate and intolerance within our borders is terrorism.
Well, that's true, and it will remain true. But the issue is still, what spurred the action that took us here? Often, we can cure a lot of problems or work to cure a lot of problems if we understand what the genesis is. And at this stage, we don't know what the genesis of this terrorism is. We know that for those who are following ISIS and those that they're being, what's the term, terrorized in place, or they're basically learning the business online and that sort of thing. And you can see it. So the FBI is able to get ahead of the curve and arrest people now.
What radicalizes.
Yeah, what radicalized. Radicalism in place, I think, is the term they're using now. So they're able to get ahead of the curve and see what's taking place among the young Somalis up in Minnesota and those around the country who are doing this online. But in homegrown terrorism, where there is no connection outside and folks are not necessarily using the internet to radicalize in place, how do we get to the genesis of this first? Unless this began at home, as we all say, you know, if you got it at home, what did your parents do? What did your parents say to you? Somebody radicalized this young man or gave him the tools to step into that church and do what he did.
And he is Dylan Roof, 21-year-old Dylan Roof. Dan has reportedly confessed to the shooting at the historically black church. It killed the pastor, who was also a state senator. He told authorities he almost didn't go through with gunning down the nine people at the Bible study group because they were being so nice to him, but that he decided he had to go through with his mission.
Well, on Jacksonville.com this morning, in our story, the latest story posted online indicates that he had confessed to an old friend while they got drunk over vodka that, quote, he'd been complaining that, quote, blacks were taking over the world and, quote, someone needed to do something about it for the white race. Now, is that recent radicalism on his case, or is that something that was grown in him, that was instilled by family, friends, something in his childhood that turned him? That's unknown, but obviously he somewhere in his later teens or early 20s decided he had a mission in life to do. And to me, that is terrorism. That is taking an action against a sector of this community, of this world, and going after it. And also brought up yesterday, this is not unlike what happened back in the 50s when a group of white men firebombed a church and killed those two girls, and the last of them actually just convicted.
You mean in Birmingham, Alabama?
Birmingham, yes.
Andrew Pantazzi.
Yeah, I mean, I think again and again when we see something like this where it seems unbelievable or it seems that we're taken aback by the news, it's important that we take a historical precedent and that we look throughout this nation's history, starting with, as Fred mentioned earlier, Denmark Vesey, who as a freed slave tried to lead a revolt to kill the white slave owners who were brutalizing and terrorizing black slaves in Charleston in the early 1800s, and going in through the 1950s and 1960s with the bombing of the Birmingham church, just struck me over and over again as I've been praying about this is what it must be like to be a black preacher or a black congregation in Charleston right now. Just going to church and not knowing if there's going to be someone there who is radicalized and seeking complete destruction and devastation.
Tim.
It's one of those situations you can't actually wrap your mind around in some ways. Honestly, I think even if you're in Charleston, that just makes it worse. But we talk about terrorism, and why that word does matter is because the idea is that it's to terrorize people. And that thought that, yeah, it changes how people live their just daily lives.
And meanwhile, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley urging prosecutors today to seek the death penalty in this tragedy. 549-2937. Dave on the north side. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. Go ahead, Dave, and turn down your radio.
How is Jane?
Hey, Dave, go ahead.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask a question. What is the difference between radical Islamic terrorists overseas killing and gunning down Christians? And then you guys over here in the States, those people was worshiping Christians, and you guys domestic terrorism people killing and gunning down Christians. To me, there's no difference. That guy said that he had to complete his mission. And to me, it's not like that he is working with other people. He's working with, to me, it sounds like he's working with some kind of organization to complete his mission, because he was, you know, the word hell bent on filling out whatever godly thing that he did. And I'll take my comments off here.
Thanks, Dave. That's Dave on the North Side. Of course, there are a number of white supremacist hate groups in South Carolina throughout the South. We don't know yet, though, Fred, if this young man was affiliated with one of them.
Well, I mean, that's the question. And we start at home, and I'm sure the authorities have already started this process. Who gave him the gun? Was the gun that they caught with him the same gun that it was given to him by his father? Who is his family? Where are they from? He didn't just arrive at this point at 21 mm-hmm. years old. We all know that. He didn't just arrive here. He was brought to this point. And that's more important, almost more important than the act that he committed himself, because this act will be committed again, unfortunately. It's going to happen again. And yes, it is terrorism, and we have to deal with it, no matter what the religion of the person or their feeling. It is terrorism. It is taking a life. It is taking a life for the wrong reason. Because, and ironically, in Charleston, guess what? The black population is declining. From 10%, it was, I think, 10, 12%. It's declining. It's been declining over the last decade. So they're not taking over anything in Charleston.
Here are a couple of tweets from listeners. What makes terrorism different from other violence is its goal is to terrorize those who remain. Its victim is not its actual target. Here's another tweet. Please focus on the victims' names, not the shooters. By talking about the victims, we honor and glorify the right people. Thank you for that. And of course, 9 people slain in this shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church, including the pastor, who was a well-regarded young rising state senator in the South Carolina legislature. We'll mention those names in just a minute. The Reverend Clementa Pinckney, age 41, the most prominent. The Reverend Sharonda Coleman Singleton, also killed. Cynthia Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lance, DePayne Middleton, Tawanza Sanders, Myra Thompson, Daniel Simmons, the names of the fallen. Susan in Mandarin. Go ahead, Susan.
Oh, yes. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to, and of course I'm very sad about what happened, and I thought I'd read somewhere that there were some racist remarks by politicians in South Carolina before this happened, and did I read that wrong, or is that one of those internet myth things? Okay, thank you.
Don't know about that, Susan, although it has been reported, Tim, in the last couple of days, protesters in South Carolina, once again, and this comes up again and again in South Carolina, demanding that the Confederate flag be taken down from the state capitol building. By state law, it cannot be.
Right. And that's one of those long-running issues that is going to get conflated with this sort of thing, where it, you know, emotions run high on both sides of that.
Lisa in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, I'd just like to say that, you know, labels are really unnecessary here. Plain and simple, this is murder. And until this country is ready to seriously address the 3 important issues at the forefront, then things are never going to change. And those 3 issues are gun control, racism, and mental illness. I'm happy to take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Lisa.
There is a certain, I don't know, an interesting position there, as all of us here, you know, we deal with words on a daily basis. And I think sometimes you can go down a rabbit hole in is it terrorism? Is it a hate crime? You know, does the label matter? Of course, it matters legally. And I think it does have an impact to say, no, this crime wasn't simply to kill people. It was to have a broader impact.
What about her comments about when it comes to those 3 points she made? Andrew.
What I'm seeing a lot of as I look at what my friends are posting or saying is I grew up in Jacksonville, and a lot of my friends are saying that there's no reason to politicize this event. I think that that's wrong, because this is an inherently political event. When 9/11 happened, not to conflate this with the 3,000 people who died there, but when 9/11 happened, that was a political event that required political solutions. And some of those solutions, whether you agree with them or not, including the Patriot Act and including expanding national security, this is, by some reporters' counts, the 14th time that the president has had to speak on a major shooting in the United States. And after 14 times, I would argue that this is a political event that requires a political solution.
Dan.
You know, gun control has been bandied back and forth for years. There are cities that have major gun control laws, and you can't get a gun without waiting periods and things like that. And yet things still happen. Sandy Hook, he had guns. He had mental issues up the wazoo, and he had guns, and no one seemed to notice or care. And then the person who should have noticed and reported immediately was the first victim, and then the kids got killed.
And if Sandy Hook didn't have gun control put into place, honestly, I don't know if there's anything that will. You look
right
at other countries that have had, you know, Australia's the example usually held up. You have a school shooting, everybody goes, holy crap, we shouldn't have guns floating around, laws that were put into place. In Australia's case, fairly quickly. You know, this is going to get tied up into a whole bunch of other political issues and race in America and gun control and you know, radicalization of kids. It's too messy to think that this actually will lead to gun control.
And the fact that he had a Confederate flag on his truck, that he had the pre-apartheid South Africa sticker on his jacket emblem, are those warning signs that even a trained person is going to notice? I don't know. Were they even warning signs, or was he just something
well,
for color?
Well, and the free speech rights. I mean, you know, if you start arresting people who have a Confederate flag mm-hmm. on their truck in South Carolina, I mean, the jails don't have enough
or,
room.
Or even if you arrest people who have the Rhodesian flag, which was the
that
other
was
flag.
That was also a white supremacist regime.
I do think that this is going to be something that will be reckoned with in this upcoming presidential election. Jeb Bush had scheduled an event in Charleston, and he immediately had to issue a statement and had to back out because of security concerns. Hillary Clinton was in Charleston the night before this event. This is something that is not going to be able to be ignored or even discussed in vague terms. I think that the national conversation is going to require specific dialogue.
And we'll take one more call on this and then move on to the other news of the week. Linda in Deerwood. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm Linda, and I am actually born and raised in South Carolina. I spent the first third of my life there. And the attitudes of this young man expressed, I wouldn't say that they are anomalies. I just think that he took action. If you let the news report, you saw the interview of his friend who said he'd been talking about this for 6 months. Well, obviously his friend didn't think it was that weird that he was talking about hurting and killing black people to notify anybody, because he just thought, well, you know, that's what we talk about, and that's what happened. I don't, the environment in South Carolina is, there are a lot of people there that are great people, but there are a lot of people there that are stuck in the past. They have a lot of loyalty to being first in the nation, to try to succeed from the, you know, nation and the Confederacy, and that's why they made it illegal to remove the flag from the State House Confederate flag that doesn't represent all the people of South Carolina. I used to be an idealist and thought that when the older segregationists who had gone through the 50s and 60s died, we'd have a new day. But when I have a 21-year-old who has learned this in the state that I was born, I'm just so torn and hopeless that we will ever, in this country, this is the bane of our existence. Just racism, and whether we speak it or not, all I just tell people is if you are in conversation with a friend that says something inappropriate, stop them. Don't tell them it's not cool with me. I don't believe in that, and I'm not going to listen to this. And I'm just broken because I met this preacher, and I have my sister and brother-in-law there, and they know him, and they're devastated that somebody would go into a church at Bible study and shoot them down like animals, like they did back in slavery time. It's just ridiculous. I'm sorry. Thank you.
That's Linda in Deerwood. Linda, thanks for sharing your thoughts. So much emotion around this. Andrew.
I have to agree with Linda. We have free speech in this country, and I'm not suggesting the government needs to limit the type of jokes that are said, but what one of his old roommates, that's Dylan Roof, one of his old roommates said was that he made racist jokes, but it didn't sound like he meant anything by it, and mm-hmm. it wasn't troubling or concerning, which I think we need to look at the speech we use. We need to look at Charleston, which that city is covered with plaques that talk about how great it is that as a colony, it was the wealthiest colony in the original colonies, and that wealth was humans. That's what they mean. They mean that they owned more slaves than anyone else, and they commemorate that, and they talk about that as if it's something to be honored as a state. And we need to think about what people around us are saying and think about the jokes they are making, and we need to confront them because it's not something that's okay, and it's not something that's just funny, and it's not something that, oh, you're being politically correct and you're being too uptight. I mean, that's just not acceptable. It's not acceptable in this day and age, or in any day and age, or in any society anywhere, that we dehumanize someone and that we use humor to put someone down or to further stereotypes or to create an impression that someone is lesser than we are.
And yet only a few years ago, there was a full Confederate funeral procession for the skeletons of the Confederate soldiers who went down in the Hunley, the Confederate submarine, once they finally recovered those bodies. And a full Confederate-era ceremony was held with procession. And while historically amazing, shouldn't that have offended people? Because the Confederacy was built on slavery and keeping it alive.
And we'll continue to discuss that story, but we do need to move on and mention a few other very important local items of the week. Chief among them, could Jacksonville's long-awaited pension deal fall apart at the finish line? The vote is happening right now, according to Twitter listeners and watchers. Disgruntled police and firefighters are urging the Pension Ford board members to reject a proposed reform plan. They say it forces too much sacrifice. Fred Matthews, will the pension fund board sign off on this deal?
It's going to be tough. And if they vote for this deal, it will probably be the last time that the pension board will represent in negotiations the fire and policemen, because I think they were pretty clear on yesterday that they want this deal voted down. And the fire and policemen have steadfastly said the pension board is who negotiates for us. Okay, while the city and everybody else says we need to be negotiating directly with the police and fire union. It is going to be a tough vote, but I think in the and here's the other kicker. I mean, the police and firemen are probably correct, not just in the fact that they want the deal voted down because of its unfairness to going forward, but it's the same thing. You're voting for a deal in which the city still has not designated a way to pay for it, which is what they've done before. So you vote for this deal, hoping that the city will approve it, with a new mayor coming in, with no money and nobody saying how you're going to do it.
Don't you have any hope? Don't you have optimism? it does look like Nate Glover is supporting it, which would mean that it will almost certainly pass. The vote hasn't actually happened yet.
According to our own contributor, A.G. Gankarski, he tweets just 3 minutes ago, Herbert and Glover both for the bill. 2-1. The pension deal needs one more board
and
vote.
And Whoop, you said I was going to support it. That's, I mean, you know, so no drama there. But the interesting thing is what Fred just said, that the long-running fight here has been the Police and Fire Pension Fund somehow became the bargaining unit for the police and firemen in a literally unique situation. That's not how it's done anywhere else. Everywhere else, the union itself negotiates. There's even a argument to be made that the Police and Pension Fund shouldn't still be in this conversation, but they are.
But they are.
And you know, the 7-year deal, again, argument that it shouldn't be that long. It should only be a 3-year deal. But it's a fascinating thing to see it come to this point, particularly coming to this point post-mayoral election, where, you know, the common wisdom a year ago was if pension reform got done, Alvin Brown was going to be reelected. Mm-hmm. Wasn't reelected. Pension reform is getting done just, you know, a couple weeks too late.
Well, you know, we have a new mayor coming in who has hired a no-nonsense guy as basically his CEO. And I cannot see how the new mayor and Sam Moussa are going to allow this thing to hang much longer. There's got to be pressure somewhere to get this deal, at least step one, approved. And then we'll figure out the funding with the new mayor and everything else, even though we've been reporting all week that there is no money for a lot of things, including all those new officers and CSOs.
Andrew.
Well, if the pension does go through today, then I would be surprised if the mayor does not sign it before then, because he can sign it immediately. And I'd imagine that Mayor Brown, this being one of the biggest achievements of his past 4 years, is finally accomplishing this. And I have to believe that there's some sense of frustration that this couldn't have happened before the election. But I would imagine that it would be signed before the new mayor.
It does give him whatever his next spot in life is. There is a certain amount of, I don't know, call it a sop, of them doing it before he left office. At least he can say
he was integral to the process.
He devoted his 4 years to doing it. And you know, the administration worked hard on it. They worked on different routes, and it was not a clear thing that it was going to get done before his term ended.
I mean, Brown's chief of staff, Chris Hand, his whole group, Fred, heavily engaged in this now as the transition is underway, the new players working to get it across the finish line.
I think we'll probably give Mayor Brown credit for this sometime down the road, but initially credit is going to go to Bill Guilford, and it's going to go to the new mayor who has to fund the deal. Because they all fought to make sure that Brown couldn't get it. It's almost like Obamacare on the national level. They fought to make sure he couldn't get it, and this is a nice win. But in the end, it was Bill Guilford took all the headlines for the last month on this deal.
And the really big challenge is going to be, how do you fund this? And that's going to be a massive challenge for the new administration to overcome, is determining where the money is coming for to pay the hundreds of millions of dollars.
And Dan, and let me jump in. Dan, as you pointed out, the person keeping a tight eye on that will be Lenny Curry's new chief administrative officer, Sam Moussa, the man whom former Mayor John Delaney once called, if he's an SOB, he's my SOB.
Yes. Well, Twitter is now saying that the pension passed, and it didn't pass 3-2, it passed 4-1.
Interesting. Wow. Who's voting against it?
I don't know yet.
Okay, well, there you have it. The pension deal is done in the city of Jacksonville. According to the Twitters, we have a deal. It looks as though we have a deal. The pension deal carries 4-1. And so we'll have more about that this afternoon on our newscast.
But we have a new mayor. We have a lot of new city council members. The learning curve is going to be massive. And you usually give a new administration X amount of months to start getting on their feet. This is something they're going to have to jump on as far as funding possibilities immediately, even when they still have the training wheels on. So it's got to get done.
You look at their transition team, though. I don't think that they are trying to take that. You know, because, yeah, everybody gives them a month or two to get their feet under them. Yeah. I don't think they're taking – that's not the mindset they have going in. I remember Mayor Brown's transition. He had a lot of great people who came. But there was a lot of advice seeking, a lot of consensus building, a lot of trying to figure out how do we start. This is basically hiring people who, to a certain amount, it's, you know, Peyton's third term.
Old hands.
Right. But these are people coming in. You know, Sam Moussa doesn't need to get up to speed.
No, that's correct.
You know, so, yeah. Susie Wiles. I mean, these are people who...
These are battle-tested City Hall insiders.
Now the problem with that can be that they come in and they have a way of doing things. And, you know, it has been 4, 6, 8 years since some of them were in those roles.
Sure.
But, they're not. There's no honeymoon there. They're hitting the ground running.
But Sam and Susie have stayed connected with things that are happening at City Hall. And Sam, as abrasive as some say he can be, is a very direct doer. And we forget he was head of public works for years prior to doing things. And a lot of projects have his name on it.
I think we're talking
about
here.
Let's get Fred back in. Fred, go ahead.
Well, just a couple of things. Well, one, I mean, and I think all of what they're saying is correct. And again, but you know, don't downplay the fact of Bill Guilford in this game. He's going to chair Finance Committee coming into this new term as one of the big heads. And Lori Boyer is still going to be there. She has a great financial head on her. And we're interested in seeing, of course, what Anna Brochet will do with her accounting background. But, you know, the interesting story of the week from this, on the transition side from Sam Moussa, do you realize that this guy's going to get paid as much as he's going to get paid more than the mayor. He's going to get paid 3/4 as much as the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. He's getting paid more than the governor makes.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just go to a city manager form of government and just make the mayor another person on the council like everybody else does? Because I don't know what about you guys, but I think this is a lot of money, and they're justifying it by saying,
it's a $300,000 a year salary.
Yeah, they're justifying it by saying, well, you know, the two combos of the last two mayor amounted to $365,000. Well, okay.
We're saving $65,000,
aren't we? But, I mean, gee whiz, you're going to come in with a budget-busting salary like this for public service? So it's not public service anymore.
Wait a minute. Now, this does make Sam Moussa the highest paid public employee, I believe, in town, next to John Delaney, the president of UNF.
Yes.
Doesn't it?
I believe it does.
Yeah.
But here's the question, though. So the first part of this that we were talking about, Sam, was, you know, if you talk to people who care about government, not in a political standpoint, but simply on a technocratic getting things done standpoint, this is the guy whose name always comes up. So if you're hiring for your business and he's the guy who's going to do it, you know, Google talks about this 10 times programmers, a programmer who's worth 10 times the average programmer. If he's the guy to do it, if he's going to save the city money,
they see that as a worthwhile investment.
It's an investment.
So does he get a bonus if he finds a way to fund the pension program without having to tax the taxpayers? Does he get a bonus for that? Does he get a bonus for cutting the grass that hasn't been cut in 6 years in many of these byways? Do we give him a bonus on top of that?
Pay cash money to see Sam Moussa pushing a lawnmower down the Hodges Boulevard median where I live, which hasn't been mowed for a while. Wow. Dan Scanlon.
For what it's worth, the sage of sages at the Times Union, Ronald Littlepage, says that Moussa will be worth every penny in his column this week, even though you would expect Ron Littlepage to gripe about a $300,000 salary.
Right,
well, the mayor's not going to take a budget cut. Is he going to take a pay cut? The last mayor took a pay cut, down from 175 to 120, and he had kids to feed also. So is this mayor going to take a pay cut? Are we going to have to pay him the full salary on top of his $300,000? And plus, don't forget, we got two other people in there, plus all the department heads who make six-figure salaries.
As Sam Moussa used to say to me, and I'll say to you, now, Fred, that was the way he would just look at you, point at you if you made a mistake.
You Fred?
We will see. Yeah. No, he would call me Dan, but I'm just trying to imitate Sam.
He called me now Fred too when I covered him at City Hall. I mean, I know Sam quite well.
Fred is raising valid questions, and I'm sure it will continue.
Well, then let's
do a
performance review in a year and see what happens.
Absolutely, and let's also touch on the fact that Jeb Bush declared for president Tuesday at a big announcement down in Miami. Now we have two top tier candidates, both the two top GOP prospects for president, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, both now hailing from Florida. Now, former friends, now adversaries. Jeb Bush saying he'll run as a strong conservative, but with a nod to younger, edgier voters. He did do a little bit of slow jamming the news this week.
Yesterday in Miami, I formally announced my candidacy for President of the United States. I thought long and hard about this decision, and after careful consideration, I determined that now was the right time to launch my campaign for the Republican nomination.
We didn't hear Fallon's bit, but Andrew Pantazzi.
I think that his announcement seems to have gone rather well, at least how it's playing in the news. While he was there, included among the things that happened was, as has been happening with announcements across the country, as immigration activists stood up and gathered attention, and he, though it wasn't part of his planned speech, addressed them, and he has made a few promises.
Spoke in Spanish. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and one of the promises he made then to the immigration activists was that as president, he would pass meaningful immigration reform through Congress. He's also promised this week a 4% GDP growth, which, if you pay attention to economics at all, is an unbelievable amount of growth.
An argument to be made that you don't actually want that level of growth, that's an overheated economy. But yeah.
And some say it would be impossible to achieve.
A very busy news week and a very robust discussion. But we do need to close very quickly with our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Now, only in Florida do arsonists set fire to their home using a bowling ball. 21-year-old Tyler Butler faces charges of first-degree arson and attempting to use a destructive device after investigators found a bowling ball in a South Florida home filled with gunpowder connected to a long rope used as a wick. It looked like something straight out of a cartoon. And in a very Florida twist, this Palm Beach County house was in foreclosure.
Can you imagine how long he had to work on drilling that hole and pack? I mean, this is dedication.
Again, he's 21 years old. Who started him down this path?
Does he fall under Florida's three strikes and you're out?
That's a good question.
We need to monitor cartoons.
Yes, they can be very damaging. And finally, only in Florida does an amateur photographer snap the pic of a lifetime. Palatka resident Richard Jones swears the image is authentic after he got a picture of a raccoon riding on top of an alligator Sunday in the Ocala National Forest. Jones says his son was walking through some palm fronds to get a picture of the gators, startled the raccoon, which hopped on top of a gator in the water. They quickly got the unique photo before the raccoon scurried back on land. Did you see that?
I've been watching this all week. I mean, I've been trying to find out whether it's fake or not.
He swears it's real.
I'm just trying to find a business angle. You know, it's like,
I want to see the series of photos, the before and after photos. Like, what other photos he has to prove that this is real?
It's him putting a stuffed raccoon on a fake alligator floating in the water.
So many cynics.
Sorry.
I knew that would capture your fancy, guys. And thank you so much, Fred Matthews, Tim Gibbons, Andrew Pantazzi, and Dan Scanlon. Thanks for being here.
Yep.
Still to come, UNF celebrates its interfaith community, but up next, marking World Refugee Day. Stay with us.
The great online auction is back, June 19th through 29th. Shop from the comfort of your home and find exciting items at a fraction of retail. From barbecue to vacation getaways, we have something for everyone at every budget. All proceeds benefit WJCT. Log on to auction.wjct.org and start shopping today.
Henry Threadgill has been one of the most inventive composers in the jazz avant-garde for the last 40 years. He turned 70 this year, and pianist Jason Moran put together a concert to celebrate his favorite composer. Parade music, tubas, a dance orchestra will feature a rare retrospective that celebrates the genius of Henry Threadgill. This week on Jazz Night in America, I'm Christian McBride.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Every day on Morning Edition, it's the news you can't do without.
This morning, we've been looking at what's happening.
There's conservatism, libertarianism, environmentalism, religion.
We're not props. We're just everyday people.
The crowd, the joy, the sense of hope.
Historic.
Listen to the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
A celebration of Jacksonville's large refugee community is set for today. Now, World Refugee Day is actually tomorrow, but several downtown events are planned for this Friday to welcome new citizens into this city. Here with more, Francis Luna and Renee Saras of Catholic Charities and Zabula FNU, who comes to our area from Afghanistan. Thank you all for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's begin with you, Renee. There's going to be a naturalization ceremony and some other activities at the Library City Hall. What's happening today?
That's right. Today, we are celebrating World Refugee Day. And to begin the celebration, we are going to honor our refugees and other individuals. The Northeast Florida Regional Refugee Task Force will hold a naturalization ceremony for 30 people who will be sworn in as American citizens, and that will take place at the Jacksonville Main Library today at 11:30. And following that, in coordination with the Hemming Park Plaza Project, several food trucks, cross-cultural entertainment, and information booths will be in Hemming Plaza to celebrate World Refugee Day.
Wow, lots happening. And Renee, there are three local resettlement agencies in town, Catholic Charities, one of them, that are very active in bringing people to our area.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. We receive our refugees are coming from various parts of the world. At the moment, we're receiving people from Iraq and Cuba. Those are our major population. We also are receiving Burmese and some Sudanese and Somalis. And the goal for us as an agency and these type of federal programs is for our clients to be economically self-sufficient. It's important for them to get, when they get here, to get a job as soon as possible so they don't become a burden to our community, to our society, and of course to the government.
So, Bula, tell us a little bit about your journey to Jacksonville from Afghanistan.
I came from Afghanistan, and I was under the threat in Afghanistan, and I came to United States and to Jacksonville.
Right. And have you been able to find a job yet? Tell us about your life right now.
Yes, I found a job 21 days ago. Yeah, 21 days ago. I'm working right now in Hamni Hotel.
Oh, okay. Excellent. So that's one example of the work of Catholic Charities, helping people who are really trying to get to a better life. And so many end up choosing Jacksonville, it seems. We have a large refugee community here.
We have a very broad cultural diversity here in Jacksonville. As Francis Luna mentioned, we have refugees coming here from many different countries. Some of the countries she mentioned, Burma, Cuba, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Ethiopia, Colombia, Syria, Russia.
And so Renee, people come from all over the world, but the motivation is the same for most refugees. They're fleeing a bad situation.
Exactly. It's not like they want to be here in the first place. It's just that based on the situations back home, because they're being politically persecuted or ethnically or because of religious reasons, the U.S. government grants them an opportunity to come here and start a better life.
And Zabula, was that your story? Is that why you came here?
Yes, because I come here and I be safe here.
And why weren't you safe in Afghanistan?
Because I was under threat in Afghanistan, and the Afghanistan situation is so bad. There was not a good situation. I was under the threat because I came to United States.
Right. So today, a celebration. People can come and witness this, right?
Yes.
Right.
We're going to be having the celebration, as Renee stated. It starts at 11. It's at the main library, USCIS, the United States Immigration and Citizenship Services. They are the ones that swear in the newly citizens. It's also an effort put on by several of the resettlement agencies in town, such as Catholic Charities, World Relief, and Lutheran Social Services. In addition to the Department of Children and Families, this is held mostly because of them, because we receive funding from all of these programs.
Again, a joyous event at 11 a.m. at the Downtown Main Library in advance of tomorrow, which is World Refugee Day, part of our diverse community here in North Florida. Thanks all of you for being with us and sharing this with our listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
We'll be back in a moment.
New look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girl Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Afternoon keynote speaker Dinah Jordan's motivational messages ring loud and true about how we can make the choice to be happy, finding the funny in your life, taking responsibility for your own health, ways to bust stress, and in doing these four things can make a happier, healthier, more productive you. Good for You, Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio.
You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through July 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Relax around the clock with the music of your life. Playing great music from Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald to James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, and more. Relax Radio, WJCT, 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Never know how much I love you.
Finally, this hour, UNF's Interfaith Center recently made history when it presented the Noor Inayat Khan Interfaith Community Service Award to two seniors for their significant voluntary interfaith community service. Khalila Jamal, a senior sociology major, and Claire Stern, a senior health science major, the first two recipients of this award, the first scholarship of its kind in higher education in the nation. Here with more, Khalila and Claire, along with Tara Trueblood, director of the UNF Interfaith Center. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And Khalila and Claire, congratulations. Very exciting. Tara, let's begin with you. How did this come about?
At the beginning of the semester, this last school year, we did the screening of a documentary made by NPR, Alex Cronimer, the producer, called Enemy of the Reich, the Noor Inayat Khan story. And it was the screening of this documentary followed by a community conversation facilitated by a president, John Delaney. And we learned the story of Noor Inayat Khan and how from her Sufi Muslim roots, she learned to serve the community and ultimately gave her life in the World War against the Nazis. And so our students came to learn about her story and be inspired by her selfless acts to make a difference and her courage to do the right thing.
So how did you both come to get involved in this and receive this award?
Oh, gosh. Well, I remember I didn't initially set out to work interfaith work. I actually did a political service project through UNF that's foundation was based in interfaith cooperation. And it was through the service project that I realized the necessity of interfaith work. And I've really been involved with the Interfaith Center ever since, and I've loved every minute of it.
Go ahead.
I actually had an interesting story. I transferred from a different university doing interfaith work and found that UNF had an interfaith center and just absolutely fell in love with the center itself and all that it does. Interfaith work has been in my life from infancy all the way up until now, and I think the importance of interfaith work is of the utmost importance.
Yeah, absolutely. And these two young ladies will get a scholarship. How exciting is that?
Very.
So
thankful too.
I bet.
And very worthy first recipients. We're so proud of them.
Absolutely. This will help pay for your education. And much more great things to come as you graduate. What do you hope to do?
Yeah, so I study sociology, political science, and education, and I've really been involved in different mentoring and nonprofit work my whole life. My big girl job would be to work in the more political side of nonprofits. I would love to lobby and advocate just for organizations that work to do really what we're doing right now. Me, Claire, and Tara.
Claire Stern.
I am a public health major with a double minor in health education and community leadership. My big girl job, as Khalila so eloquently put it, my dream job would probably be working just in anything regarding public health and interfaith work.
Well, I'm sure great things are in both of your futures, and kudos and congratulations. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's the first ever Interfaith Community Service Award presented to two seniors at UNF. Tara Trueblood directs the UNF Interfaith Center. Claire Stern and Kalila Jamal joining us in studio. Thanks for being here. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too.
And that's our show. Thanks for tuning in. Diane Reams up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Thanks for tuning in. Stay cool out there. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.